so many ways to say I love you in different languages across the land. You haven't heard them all, so I'll tell you as only a true geek can.
Hello and welcome to Geekfully Yoked, the world's best married Christian geek podcast. As always, I'm Lehman Kessler.
And I'm Rachel Kessler.
That's Mother Rachel Kessler.
I'm a priest here in the Anglican Diocese of Toronto and a PhD in medieval literature, which makes me a giant nerd.
And I jingled and jangled baby toys for my YouTube show this year, and I'm a huge nerd. We are joined this week by a special guest, international traveler and scholar extraordinaire, Dr. Andrew Reeves. Welcome, Andrew.
Hello.
Andrew is one of our oldest Toronto geek friends, I believe.
I think you were actually my very first friend in Toronto.
Now, did you meet Andrew while he was talking about Dungeons & Dragons, or like shortly thereafter?
I met Andrew playing Paranoia.
Oh.
Yes. You did.
But that night was also the evening I met another mutual friend of ours, which involved a very large discussion about why third edition of D&D was vastly inferior to second edition or something.
Ah, yes, I remember that mutual friend. For when I met him a year prior, we had that same conversation.
And I think I got that conversation
probably
as well. I like third edition.
Yeah, I know. I know you do.
And Andrew is up here doing a bit of a scholastic work after recently making the tenure track, that coveted plum in the academic world. And we're very happy to have him here, even if he is having to swelter in the surprisingly hot Canada heat.
Yes. And correct me if I'm wrong, Andrew, but your area of research is 13th century Sunday school?
Pretty much.
Yes.
Religious education. 13th century England. Basically, I study long dead people who went to church.
Andrew is very involved in much of our geek life for our several first years here in Toronto, and he's been mentioned many times on this show.
Our geek life and also our geek church life.
That's true. Yes, Andrew completely fills out the Venn diagram of church friend and geek friend.
And indeed, we were confirmed together into the Anglican Church of Canada.
We were.
Even though you've now gone south, back to the Episcopal Church.
Yes, with our strange politics and our extreme viciousness over issues of ecclesiastical properties and the gay.
Indeed.
Yeah, we're a little. This is one of the reasons why I enjoy the Anglican Church of Canada.
It's just too cold most of the time to be able to like worry about these things.
We're very polite.
Yes, very polite. Much more tea-based religion. Now, Andrew was there as we worked our way through various TV shows. I think we were watching Lost together and Arrested Development. We sort of showed Andrew a lot of things, and you were kind of a receptacle for much of our various fan excitements.
Indeed, including Farscape, which...
Yes!
I sucked you into email.
One of Rachel's great converts.
Which led to yesterday afternoon having a mini Farscape marathon with our mutual friend Giselle and her new boyfriend, trying to indoctrinate him into the ways of John Crichton.
And how did that work out?
It did result in Andrew explaining, sharing his thoughts on where the series would progress in Latin.
And the reason I did this was, of course, because I wanted to avoid spoilers for our friend, and the only way I could think to discuss potential spoilers with the three PhDs in medieval studies and the non-medievalist was for us to switch over to Latin.
So what would peacekeepers be?
Pacifex.
Right.
Or Pacifex or Pacifex, depending on how you're pronouncing it.
Okay, well, I suppose that works. But what is Latin for frel?
Frel.
How do you?
I think there's a reason why the translator microbes don't translate that.
Oh,
it is a non-translatable concept.
It is the word.
But as we were discussing before we started recording, and I was cut off, I was recalling the incident back in like 2005 when Serenity came out.
Yes.
When we were attempting to discuss certain things that happened to particularly favorite characters in German. While playing Latin Scrabble on the porch of the Center for Medieval Studies.
I think we win for nerdery is the upshot of all of this.
True enough. Now, there's one thing that we've desperately tried to get Andrew into for years and years and years. While we were living all together and when we could have discussed
before, before we even got married.
Oh, that's true. It was before
that
I even came.
Before you were even living in Toronto and knew this man, I was trying
to. In fact, I think, Andrew, you and Rachel engaged in a sort of gentleman's agreement. Is that not true?
There is a truth to this.
Would you like to describe, Rachel, this agreement and how it was broken?
Well, there was an agreement that Dr. Reeves here, or soon-to-be Dr. Reeves, would read Game of Thrones, and I would read Gene Wolfe's
Book of the New
Book
Sun.
Book of the New Sun, which... I read the first two volumes.
I left my part of the pact unfulfilled. In fact, I borrowed Dr. Kessler's copy of Game of Thrones, lost said copy, bought her a new copy in shame and remorse, and then found the lost copy of this book.
In someone else's house.
Yes.
I believe I was actually there for that particular discovery in the middle of our D&D game. But things have changed. You have repented of your ways, and you have now entered the fold.
Yes. Not only had all of my friends in Toronto insisted upon this, but once I relocated to Augusta, would you believe that people who train in late medieval and early modern sword, stick, and quarterstaff fighting would also be very into Game of Thrones?
So it's fascinating to see, because you've been worldwide. And when did you start reading Game of Thrones?
I started reading Game of Thrones about a month ago,
And where are you now in this series?
I am now into A Feast for Crows.
All right, so we're going to have a sort of bizarre, sort of quasi-spoiler warning, because we're going to be spoiling everything up to what Andrew has read. He has not watched any of the TV show, and he has not read the book and three quarters that Rachel and I
read. But we thought this would be an interesting opportunity to chat with someone who is in the midst of the world of Westeros unfolding.
Yes, well, because, you know, I read them so early, and as
soon as they... Well, you were a really early adopter.
Well, not super early. I mean, 2002, I think, is when I picked up Clash of Kings, not realizing it was book two in a series, and being a little confused. But I read them, you know, before the TV shows and sort of, like, burned my way through, and as soon as the new ones come out, I tend to burn my way, except with this last one. This last one I did drag my feet on, and I think you and other people were getting very upset at me.
I was.
It took me, like, a month or two more to finish it than everyone else.
It's very true.
We were
sort of, like, racing through it at one point.
Yeah.
Like, we were pretty neck and neck.
I just don't read. I just don't read anymore. I don't have, like, a set good time for reading. When there's so many podcasts, and when you can read about, you know, MRAs, I mean, there's just...
Oh, let's not go down that road!
But you're now right in the midst of it, and so it's exciting for Rachel and myself to sort of see you discovering things and to be on Facebook where you sort of scream in your horrible rote 13 coded dialogue. Although, I can tell from the placement of the exclamation marks and, like, you know, by counting consonants, like, just where you are and who you're upset with.
You could simply copy and paste.
Which is what I eventually did, yes. But it was sort of like, you know, you see four syllables or four letters followed by eight exclamation marks. And you think, ah, I know who he's upset at, who he thinks is walking into a trap when he obviously is. But one thing I'm also curious about is, again, when Rachel and I were reading it, we were reading it back when Game of Thrones was a popular fantasy novel, but was not the popular fantasy novel. And so, you know, no one was really talking about it on Facebook. You know, occasionally someone on LiveJournal might, like, make some reference. It wasn't the situation where you log into Facebook and there are 800, like, you know, screams about, like, spoilers and what's going on. And, you know, people have the random, like, GIFs images from, you know, the internet, like, making all sorts of meme craziness. So I'm curious what it is like for you to be reading Game of Thrones in 2013 as opposed to either 2003 or 2004 or 5.
Well, it is a cultural phenomenon. And what finally pushed me over the edge to reading it was not, sadly, the Reverend Dr. and Mr. Kessler's insistence, nor was it my friends in Augusta's insistence that I read it, but rather that people's Twitter and Facebook feeds on the night of the Red Wedding suddenly erupted in shock and horror. And I realized that if this event in this book is enough to create such an impact throughout social media, then I should give it a read. And to be frank, showing up at my sword and stick fighting class and having to say, I intend to read this. I'm now going to go to the other side of the room while I wait for you to discuss this, finally got old.
Fair enough.
And so when I read it, I'm reading it in this context of it is a cultural phenomenon. Especially if you're a little bit of a nerd, that means that all of your friends are also kind of saturated in it. And so it's very strange. But this actually ties into discovering nerdery in the year 2013 or in the early 2000s is very, very different. You folks grew up in the late 80s and 90s, and it's very different in this day and age when there are these cultural phenomena, thanks at least to social networking, thanks to at least various aspects of nerd culture being a somewhat more acceptable subculture. And so I think Game of Thrones is sort of a way to, writ large, describe nerd culture going from this kind, these kind of strange eddies and currents to being something that's on the cultural map and something that is kind of acceptable and not this strange freakishness. For example, when I was a child reading Tolkien, it was very much, there was me. When I was a child reading Tolkien, it's very much me, and I think two friends I had in high school who'd also read it. And so it is this strange private world. And thus, when I watched Tolkien on the big screen in the year 2000, it was as though my imaginary friend from childhood that no one knew about was suddenly in a Cineplex. And so Martin's been like that as well, as it becomes a cultural phenomenon.
Now, you did not grow up in a particularly nerdy environment, I have to imagine.
Angleton, Texas is not a nerdy environment.
See, this is sort of a theme we sort of keep coming back to, is that because both of my parents were not huge sci-fi sort of fans, but were enough of sci-fi fans and fantasy fans that we sort of, they allowed my brothers to be really into it. You know, I grew up just with geek stuff all over the place. You know, like, you know, there was, I could, you know, remember seeing, you know, the old kind of like 70s editions of, you know, The Lord of the Rings sitting on the bookshelf, you know, next to the C.S. Lewis. You know, just, you know, all of this was sort of folded in so that in a weird way, like, nerd culture just seemed like a default thing. You know, just felt like, of course you keep fantasy and sci-fi books around. Of course you have, like, random monster manuals, like, in your den. Almost in the same way that, you know, like, my default was, well, of course, you know, you have Bibles and books on Bible commentary. Like, in a weird way, Christianity and geek culture are strangely, like, intermolded in my head just because they were so casually accepted in my household. So it's fascinating to see that dichotomy as well, having to discover a geekery on your own, as opposed to being like me, where it was sort of like, well, okay, you're going out, here's your nerd card.
And that is, it creates a different experience because you will have never known the frustration of having this strange private world that everyone looks at you kind of weird for being interested in. You'll have never known that unpleasantness, but you'll also have never known the excitement of, in the early 90s, buying a 486, hooking an analog phone line into the wall, and suddenly discovering a world of people who are into this. You'll never know the excitement.
I am not alone.
Yes, of talking to people in your platoon and finding out that, yes, they too are into this sort of thing. And then getting introduced to Dungeons and Dragons by your fellow Marines, because I was a Korean linguist in the Marine Corps. These are sort of the, they are the nerds of the military.
Okay.
They're still the military, but they're the nerds of the military.
And it should be pointed out that the military is surprisingly full of nerds.
Oh, yeah.
A rule I learned very quickly is that if you've got an army post or some sort of, you know, military base in a town, it is going to have at least two gaming stores.
Yes, and indeed, two of my best friends in the Augusta area who have since moved away, Joel and Maya Thompson, I'm naming you on this podcast, but I met them through a wonderful Call of Cthulhu game, and then a game that excellently melded the systems of Star Wars and Call of Cthulhu.
Excellent.
So is there a reverse now with George R. R. Martin where rather than opening up and discovering that other people are sharing this private world of yours, you are now sort of becoming part of this cultural phenomenon and things that people have been talking about around you for years now suddenly make sense?
Exactly! Exactly! Suddenly, everything being said about the first men and animal relations and
Incest?
He read Wedding, and I think they didn't mention the incest, but everything that I heard snatches of, and the Red Wedding horror, it all made sense.
I have to imagine it would be like when I was reading the Harry Potter books, just sort of, I kind of like, you know, well, you know, I'm hearing everyone talk about it, I might as well sort of like get into it, and sort of, you know, you've heard things, and you know things, and they're sort of out there, and maybe you saw like one or two of the movies, you know, but like, you're now opting into the cultural phenomenon.
Right.
Yes, and so that was shocking. Although it's fantastic.
So what have been some of your favorite discoveries in the world of Westeros?
My favorite discoveries about the world or as they happen in the world?
Either. Start with my
favorite discovery of the world is that, yes, it is a COD medieval setting. It is fantasy Western Europe. Across the ocean is fantasy medieval Lombardy, and then further east is fantasy Mongolia, and then further east is fantasy China.
Fair enough.
And then to the south is, of course, fantasy ancient Rome. But the thing that I have found wonderful is that George R.R. Martin has a really good sense of the late medieval court. Because one thing I try to explain when I'm teaching my students about late medieval history, and especially court politics, is that you essentially first need to understand by take everything you know about ethics and then subtract that, and then add in a whole lot of Jesus, and you get a late medieval court. And Martin captures, I think, the ethical feel of the medieval court better than many fantasy writers. And by ethics, I mean there are none. That, I think, has been the most exciting, but also the little touches that show that Martin is fairly familiar with the history of pre-modern Europe. My favorite example is, why are the wildlings pushing south against the wall and pushing against the frontier?
Well, obviously because they're uncivilized orcs who only know war in their hearts.
Except that's not true, and that is why I love it. They are in fact being pushed by horrible ice vampires, and thus I can see how Martin is thinking of the end of our own world's Roman Empire. When Germans are pushing against the borders of Rome, because behind them are these Huns who are pushing against them, and they're just trying to escape the Huns.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see King Stannis, king at the wall, settling the wildlings on the frontier in exchange for defense. And I see that Martin is thinking of the late Roman Empire. So these little historical details that show he's thinking of our world's history, but also that he understands how a court works.
One thing, Rachel and I have talked about this before, and it's something I really like, is I do like his religion. I really like the various religions in this world. I feel like they are not just a sort of palette swap. I believe in gods because, you know, people used to believe in gods. And so, you know, I am a knight. I believe in, like, the war god. I am a cleric. I believe in the healing god.
The other version of that that I hate in fantasy is, we are the Schmishtians, and we are sex-hating killjoys, and paranoid, and unbending, and unflexible, and think we're good, but we're actually evil, sex-hating killjoys, because I'm not at all based on a Baptist you didn't like in high school. And Martin doesn't do that.
No.
His religions feel like real religions, and as you guys
said, like their own thing.
Yes.
As opposed, there's not one of them that is clearly just a substitute for Christianity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that was what you guys pointed out in an earlier podcast of this very series, was that the religion, it's like our world, and that every one of the religions is plausible.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. I love the fact that something grants these prayers, some entity that they call a good god, of which I am suspicious.
Yeah, you're really fixated on the red god, aren't you?
Yes.
What? R'hllor is your friend.
Good gods do not birth shadow babies to murder people in their sleep.
Well, you know, it just sort of depends on what part of the, you
know. It's all about your perspective,
precisely.
Right? That's what George R. Martin is all about.
And matters of import, you know, unity and I don't know how the rest of that goes.
Yeah. So what are your favorite discoveries going through the story?
My favorite discoveries, I think, have been the unfolding revelations. I would say my favorite has been gradually figuring out what the deal is with the ice vampires who live in fantasy Scotland.
Yes.
In addition to that, and this is a bit of a cliche when folks talk about Martin, but it's true, has been seeing that, oh, this person who is supposed to be terrible and I'm waiting for their death so that they go to the Song of Ice and Fire hell and I can celebrate.
I think it's called King's Landing.
When the viewpoint shifts to their point of view, you see, ah, they're not totally odious. And the thing that I've loved, this isn't quite a discovery. I'm not always so much of a plot junkie as I am watching it kind of get told. And I love the way Martin creates handsome characters who are, of course, hideous and evil on the inside, and how the closest thing to a good person in House Lannister is a misshapen dwarf with a hideous face and a waddle.
Okay, now, this is a bit of a digression, so I apologize, but you've also recently gotten into the Miles Vorkosigan books, yes?
Yes.
Now, do you see Miles Vorkosigan as a version of Tyrion Lannister if he'd been raised by parents who loved him?
Yes.
Okay.
They are suspiciously similar. George R. R. Martin denies that they're based on the same person, but I have my suspicions.
Didn't he say to you when you asked him that at a...
Well, yeah, I asked him, like, oh, Mr. Martin, you know, it seems that Miles Vorkosigan and Tyrion seem very similar. He's like, well, I can understand why you might think that. I think the general idea is that if you make a character who has, like, gross physical deformities and, you know, is sort of weaker than everyone else, you're inclined to sort of try to make them the smartest guy in the room or to make them really charming. Because if you make a disabled character and then you just make them dumb and... unlikable, that's just mean.
Everyone out there should read the Miles Vorkosigan books. They're awesome, too.
Imagine if George R. R. Martin understood women and had an editor.
Yeah.
One thing I know you enjoy from your love of all things Conan is the way magic in this world works.
Yes. I like the magic because it is not, as in some fantasy systems, you tap these magic wells, and then as long as you've got the drilling equipment, you can access magic, and then you cap the well head when you are done. It is not that. It is not the here is your table of spells by how old you have become. Nor is it even an ooh-ah sort of magic. So when magic breaks out, magic is rare enough that... you can plausibly argue that it does not exist.
Mm-hmm.
And so when magic does break out, though, the reaction is not, ooh, ah, we are returning to an age of wonders. It is, holy crap, this is frightful deviltry!
That was one of the things the two things really attracted me to Martin. One was the complete lack of elves. and two is the fact that the magic in it was rare and dangerous. And when it showed up, it was problematic, and it was just as likely to hurt the sort of, you know, quote-unquote caster as, like, whoever was being sort of, you know, put on. Maybe that comes from reading the second book first, or at least the first part of the second book, and seeing that, you know, this sort of wise old meister, you know, going and collecting his poisons and doing this thing that has to be done to, you know, to kill the serpent and save, you know, his king. And, you know, and then just watching as he himself dies. You know, and you're like, oh, so that's what this world is like.
Yes.
Where the good people make, you know, the hard moral choices and still lose.
Yes. And the thing about that sort of magic, the dangerous magic, is that it makes it look more like our world. Because in our world... up until very recently, you could plausibly say that magic might exist or plausibly deny it. But if there was magic, everyone would agree that magic is a rare thing. And that's also useful because if magic is fully common and easily accessible and follows a strict system of rules, it's not magic, it's science. And the world is no longer our world because you can essentially apply magic. You don't need to invent the printing press. You simply have these spells where quills write themselves and you can mass produce books. You can make railroads that run upon earth energies. And so if you have reliable magic, it's not going to be pre-modern Europe for very long.
No. No, I've always thought about that. Like, I think when third edition began introducing, like, essentially everlasting fireballs, like you could just sort of cast... like, you know, just like little small flame spells at will. I was like, well, why wouldn't someone just get a bunch of these, like, level one wizards and make them sit around a vat of water and essentially have, like, a steam-powered kingdom forever?
Exactly. And later D&D with its... Oh, of course there are airships that go all around Faerun. Kind of tried to say, well, what's happening if magic is accessible? But then it turns into something that's not kind of like our world.
Yeah.
But just, you know, twisted 15
degrees. It's also what happens when, you know, gamers are presented with a system and game it. And take it to its logical, terrible conclusion.
Yes. In the campiest manner possible.
True enough. So luckily Martin has avoided a lot of the kind of, I feel, the pitfalls of, like, a lot of fantasy. I mean, he's made it really hard to go back and read a lot of fantasy for me.
Yeah, after getting through the first three books of Game of Thrones, I then realized that, no, I don't actually need to finish Wheel of Time. And so I went to Wikipedia, and I looked up the summary of the final three books and said, done.
well done. You cliff noted it.
So what are your thoughts on where the next two books... Because you just started these books,
right.
Yes?
Well, as you know, I am suspicious of Rahaelor the Fire Lord.
Indeed.
And why he is bringing people back hideously disfigured from the dead.
You know, for justice?
I am suspicious of...
Zombie Caitlin,
but of that whole priesthood. I am suspicious of the Assassin's Guild that Arya is joining.
Yes.
But excited. Arya, by the way, in Sanskrit means noble.
Oh, well, there we go. Very nice.
Yes. Nice little touch.
The actress who plays Arya, right after the Red Wedding, like, went on Vine, which is, like, sort of a bizarre, like, video Twitter thing.
The 6-second video social networking site that all the kids are on these days.
Put, like, with the video sort of camera right in her face being vaguely cross-eyed, and I think doing a southern accent.
I think so.
Just went, they did. My brother, my mother, they all did. And the fact that Vine auto loops just meant that I could just sit there and just watch her go over and over going, they did. They all did. My mother, my brother, they did. And that was all I needed to do in an evening. I was thinking to myself, Arya Stark, you are not taking this seriously. What would Sansa think? Where do you think things are going? I'm interested in sort of seeing your opinion as of now and how it sort of will juxtapose with where I thought the series was going, because there was a big gap between 3 and 4. I mean, that's where I read all three of the books and then got to wait for 4 to come out and then wait for 5 to come out.
I will first off say that I was utterly wrong in where I thought the War of the Five Kings was going.
Oh, yes?
Well, I assumed that naturally it would devolve into a north-south split because taking and holding the neck is fairly difficult.
Yeah.
But I also figured it would be fairly easy for the Lannisters to consolidate the south. And of course, so Martin totally upended my expectations.
Yes.
Especially with Theon's heel turn.
Yes.
But we shall not discuss that. Oh, but I will discuss. This was one of my favorite things of House Greyjoy. And how when Martin does pastiche, he does it knowingly and with a little bit of a wink in his eye.
All right.
And that is why I love him as opposed to a lot of other fantasy that uses the pastiche, but a little bit less knowingly.
So define this particular pastiche.
Well, he decides that he will make a group of people who are Cthulhu-worshipping Vikings.
That works.
And so when this person gets baptized into the faith of Viking Cthulhu and recites the words, "What is dead may never die," you see Martin behind his computer screen winking mischievously at his readers.
Yes.
Likewise, in the Dany chapters, which I know that many fans have mixed feelings on.
Indeed.
We have mixed feelings.
Yes.
I liked Daenerys up until about halfway through Dance of Dragons.
Yeah. She and Caitlin were always my break chapters.
Whereas I enjoy the Dany chapters, not necessarily for Dany, who's like, I am very good and don't understand why everyone hated my saint and father and brother.
Danny, and I have the blood of the dragons.
Danny, that eye roll didn't come through on the camera, by the way, when he was there. Danny, but the settings that Danny wanders through are pure Robert E. Howard.
Yes.
But they are pastiche of Howard done by a man knowingly saying, I will take some sword and sorcery and inject it into my high fantasy. And, for example, when he refers to stout-bodied slaves clad in naught but a loincloth, if you have read any Conan stories, not modern Conan stories, but the original Robert Howard written in the 30s stories, when you talk about a huge, muscular, dusky slave clad in naught but a loincloth, this is willing imitation that says, I know, you know, that I know what I'm drawing my sources from.
Yes.
And that, and so I totally digressed because I really enjoy when he does pastiche, he does it in a deft and knowing way.
Okay.
Going back to what I'm expecting for the future.
Yes.
I have no idea what's going to happen with the King on the Wall. None at all.
Yes.
I can't possibly foresee Stannis being able to raise the North or get them on his sheet of music.
Yes.
But I love Stannis because he is so stubborn.
Yep.
That he's never going to bend the knee, and so he just kind of keeps on keeping on.
Yep.
And so I have no idea what's going to happen with the King of the Wall. And the Lannister disintegration. The Lannister disintegration is so fantastic.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, there's a certain trope I don't like, and I see it, and I feel like I've seen it in sci-fi more than fantasy. But it's a sort of the idea of like a writer creates an unstoppable foe. You know, some like force that's just like, you know, the villains are just too good at everything. They always manage to like get the upper hand, and like there's no way the heroes can really beat them. And so what inevitably happens is they have some sort of internal collapse, and in the midst of like, you know, the second son will kill the king, and then like they'll descend into conflict, and that's how the heroes will win. The heroes will win not by doing anything, but just simply waiting for the sort of natural untrustworthiness of the enemy to take over. And I've never really liked that. I find that sort of lazy, and it's like, well, you know, what are you doing? You know, we're just sort of waiting for the bad guys to kind of fall apart. And the Yuuzhan Vong stuff did it in Star Wars. I remember reading a really awful, political thriller where China invades America, and the only way America manages to survive is because there's, like, a coup back in China. And it's just, it's really hackneyed. But this really set it up well. And this, like, you know, the fact that you're having Tyrion killing his own father, like, is to some degrees comes out of nowhere, but it's also pretty telegraphed. Like, it makes sense, and it works well, and it doesn't just feel like, oh, you know, the Borg had, like, a virus implanted in it, and now they're tearing each other apart.
Well, much of what he does is highly telegraphed. That's why the Red Wedding is great.
Yeah.
You know, there's the prophecy of the dead wolf in his hall. There's horrible Lord Frey saying, oh, this is going to be a great wedding. But the collapse of Lannister, as you said, if you're doing a good novel, it's character-driven, a good modern novel.
Yeah.
That's character-driven. The fall of the Lannisters is a kind of natural outgrowth of that.
Well, the fact that they're sort of, they're fallen, but they're still not, like, they're such a shambling giant that even with, like,
even in total disarray, they're still probably,
they cannot be ignored.
They're still the 800-pound gorilla, you know,
yeah.
Like,
trapped. They're the 800-pound gorilla with, like, a stick in its eye.
That with you know, that this that's still holding all the debt of the kingdom.
Yes. But it's an, but Lord Tywin, with his, being a horrible, unloving, hateful old bastard, or not a bastard, no, he's of good birth, but being a horrible, unloving jerk, essentially made everything fall apart.
Yeah.
And I kind of like that.
Yeah.
Although this is a I'm going to now totally digress into medievalist territory.
I like it.
And note that I still, the one thing about Martin is that these characters still think in a somewhat modern way.
Okay.
There's still a little, I think, too much introspection and interiority.
But as, I mean, you and I were having this debate a couple days ago, that if you're going to write a modern novel, that interiority is a benchmark of the modern novel.
It's,
I mean,
a benchmark.
From the 18th century,
yes,
on.
Yes, it is a modern novel. But one of the things I find just fascinating about late medieval history is there's, I think it's Thomas of Lancaster, wrote this devotional work called Le Livre de Sainte Médecine, The Book of Holy Doctors, which is this devotional tract about how the saints help you in your Christian life. And it's about learning how to be more holy in his personal life. And if you were to just read this, you would think, my, what a wonderful Christian this guy must be. But then if you read about the rest of his life, like in war with France, and you read about men under his command simply murdering and raping civilians across the French countryside. And then you wonder, because there's this introspective work, and yet there's this completely non-introspective, I will now run on murder because, I don't know, I'm a late medieval knight.
Yes.
And so, to some extent, I'd kind of like, I don't know if it would be possible with the conventions of the modern novel, but to see more medieval figures, to see more, we are erratic and impulsive and don't think through our motives at all.
Indeed. That's what the mountain's for.
That's true. The mountain is a very good late medieval knight.
Is there good? Is there gold? Is there silver? Where is Beric Dondarrion? Oh, that's still awesome. I still love that scene.
And now he's festering.
Yay, festering. So you've been talked a lot about the sort of the Red Wedding and the death of Tywin, but what have been some of your, like, the moments you've seen along the way that have really just, like, made you go, okay, yes, this is a series that's worth reading all of in a month?
I suspect...
I'll make it easier. What kept you reading in Game of Thrones despite it being something of a slog?
Because, I mean, Game of Thrones does start slow, let's be honest.
I could tell... There was a very... I'm watching a chessboard. Maybe not a chessboard. I'm screwing my metaphor up. But I'm watching someone set up this really artful diorama.
Okay.
And so watching the diorama get set up, and the foreshadowing, and the realizing, because all of my friends had said, don't get too attached to anyone, especially the good and honorable characters, that once you hit a certain point... You realize that poor Ned is just hosed.
Yes.
Pretty much once his retinue makes it through the gates of King's Landing,
yes.
You already know the jaws of the trap have closed on him. And so it's like watching a tragedy. You're watching and thinking, how are the Starks going to suffer? What horrible doom is going to fall upon them? And then once the doom has fallen...
Yeah.
But then at that point, once the Lannister coup kicks off, you then get into two very fat books. But they're very fat books where lots of stuff is happening, happening.
Yeah.
And so everything leading up to the Lannister coup, I thought, it grabs you because the tension builds. You get this kind of... pulling tighter and tighter and tighter, and you wonder when it's all going to snap. That's what kept me going. The kind of exciting moments, the crazy discoveries, like, obviously Tywin winning the Battle of Red Fork.
One of them, sure.
Yeah.
The battle outside King's Landing. That is clearly telegraphed.
Yeah.
You know exactly how that battle is going to go, and that the
Blackwater?
The Battle of Blackwater, thank you. The Battle of Blackwater is going to end in a Lannister victory just because of how clearly telegraphed it is. But
it's robbed from Tyrion.
Well, of course. And Tyrion only survives by a nose.
Indeed.
Well, I mean, in some ways, Clash of Kings... I mean, Sword of Swords is my favorite one, but I love Clash of Kings as the story of Tyrion doing everything right.
And
getting nothing.
And Storm of Swords is watching how it all falls apart. Tyrion builds up. He's got his allies. He's got his whole network.
Oh.
He's got his system of taxes in place.
Yeah.
And then Bronn walks out on him.
Oh, my goodness. One of the best things the TV show has done is the Bronn and Tyrion relationship. Like, Bronn is one of the characters who has blossomed in the TV show.
If the books are really good, and this is a new thought I'm having, so we'll see if it goes anywhere. If the books are really good at sort of, like, showing you these multiple perspectives and sort of living inside someone's head, or at least resting on their shoulder and seeing the world through their eyes, what the TV show has done really well is showing the intersection of people, showing relationships.
Mm.
Like interactions are much... like tighter and more interesting. That's just because you're not just like seeing one person react and see
well, and my theory is that the women come off a lot better.
They do.
I really, because I mean, as we have discussed, George R. R. Martin cannot get inside the head of a woman to save his life.
She felt the breasts inside of her outfit.
I don't want to go in. Like, I have mentioned this on the podcast before, and I just do not want to go into my frustration with the way George R. R. Martin writes sexuality. Like, it's just...
What? I obviously every morning get up when I'm going to the washroom say, I have a penis. Isn't it neat to be a man and have a penis? Perhaps I will have sex as a man with a penis. Yeah.
But I feel like, so there are these really, really talented actresses, Lena Headey, for one, right? Who just bring a great deal of depth to the, so you see in Circe, as twisted and as messed up as she is, there is this desire to do right by her children. This desire to protect her children.
And that is also, though, how he creates a really good late medieval mentality. What is the most important thing? It's family. It's your lineage. It's your group. And that is where he beats every single other modern fantasy writer with a little asterisk except for Tolkien, because most modern fantasy writers are writing about the bourgeois subject.
Well, and while we can say that there is a bit too much interiority in George R. R. Martin for it to be a true medieval epic, he still is not... The idea of these people having individualistic agendas is by and large
they do sort of subject themselves to things, and you see like fealty come across. I mean, like Davos is fascinating not just because he's an interesting character, but because of his loyalty to his
team, and
in spite of everything else.
Well, one might argue that the only character with truly individualistic agendas is Littlefinger, who represents the rise of the bourgeois middle class, right?
Yeah, exactly. He is the tax collector and the moneymaker, and
the self-made man.
The self-made man. I've never thought about that.
He's totally...
He is Westeros' John Galt. Which is why he is going to destroy the kingdom.
Yeah. He even retreats into a valley hidden in the mountains.
See?
To let the world burn. My goodness, of course, Littlefinger... This is why I love Martin. Martin has a sense of history. Littlefinger is a noble of the robe versus a noble of the sword.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've managed to unearth some secrets there.
Indeed. So, who do you think is Jon Snow's parentage?
I suspect... No, I am not going to take credit for this. My friend Stuart Stenser... One of the only two provosts of the American Academy of English Martial Arts now. He's recently gotten his prizing. But my friend Stuart Stenser has suggested that Jon Snow's father, or Jon Snow's mother, is in fact a Targaryen.
Hmm.
And this is obviously not revealed in Feast or Dance, but...
I think we can probably talk about our theories pretty safely.
I think we can talk about our theories pretty safely.
If she's a Targaryen... That gives Jon Snow...
Oh, Rachel and I,
Rachel and I both believe that Jon Snow has a Targaryen parent, but we believe it is...
Rhaegar Targaryen.
It is Rhaegar Targaryen and Lyanna Stark.
Is the mother.
Who is not kidnapped and raped, but ran off with her true love. And if Eddard had revealed this...
Okay,
for the sake of our listening audience, you really need to see Andrew's eyes bugging out of his head.
No, because... A, there's stuff that it's been a while, but there's stuff that is revealed during Dany's magical like journey through the plot myths, journey through the exposition, like, you know,
the Hall of Exposition.
But there's stuff that goes on, and there's just enough. I feel there's enough that's there in the text to suggest the fact that Lyanna Stark was not kidnapped. Lyanna Stark and Rhaegar ran off. Had an affair, had a child. Of course, we know how well who am I thinking of? Was the Robert Baratheon?
Robert Baratheon.
And since we know how well Robert Baratheon sort of views the world and all of its in his understanding of reality, I think he casts himself as the hero and can't possibly, you know, countenance the notion that Lyanna Stark could love another person. And you know, and we also know what he feels about surviving Targaryen children. So yeah, that's my theory.
The idea that Ned has been Sorry, I was chasing down the dog, so you might not have heard that. Yes, I agree, Bilbo. So this idea that Ned has been bearing this shame for his entire life, that is not even his own shame, but to protect his sister.
Yeah, and her son.
I want that to happen.
And because of how Westerosi genetics works, brunettes trump everything. So.
Although,
yes. And the seed is strong, remember.
Punnett squares bend to George R. R. Martin's will.
Although.
Yes.
As far as we can tell, Warg. Oh, yeah, but if it's on the distaff side.
He still has Stark blood in him.
That would mean he could control dragons as well. Yes. That is, by the way. One of the things that I love about this is, with the exception of the Cthulhu Viking Greyjoys, and of course the Lannister, there's a lot of really good claims for legitimacy.
Very true.
You know, Dany wants to rule well. She's a legitimate heir. Stannis has the legitimate right, etc. And now I have to say something that I also meant to say earlier. What I love about this is the story of Game of Thrones is actually a story about the move from one generation to another.
Mm.
It's a story of the passing of the torch. It's the story of going from Cersei and Ned and Tyrion's generation to Bran and Arya and Sansa and their generation.
It's interesting you say that, because George R. R. Martin was originally going to have a huge time gap between, was it
Feast
for 3 and 4? Yeah, there was going to be a huge time gap between 3 and 4 to allow the children to grow up. Part of why things got convoluted was he realized that actually he needed to tell that story and there was too much that needed to happen.
Why kind of 3 ends on this really pitch perfect note,
it's a good stopping point,
Empire Strikes Back style, looking out, you know, you're sort of able to take a breath, but like, you know, stuff is coming. But then he, as opposed to sort of having this gap and telling like 10 years later here's where everyone is, he was like 5 minutes later here's what happened.
And it's
just a touch jarring.
I defend Feast for Crows. I know a lot of people don't like it. I think given that some of the characters don't appear in it, it makes it a tighter story. And it really, I mean, not to get into spoiler territory, but it really is Cersei's story.
Yeah.
And I think it's actually fairly tight, and it's there are some things about it that I really like. And I think the title, Feast for Crows, is really apt.
Yeah.
Because it is the crows coming out and feasting on the carcass of the kingdom. And I like that image.
I
defend the first half of Dance with Dragons was really good, and then
it keeps spinning.
And then it's like 600 pages longer than it needs to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think I like Feast for Crows. If Dance with Dragons had been better, I would have liked it more.
I feel like
Feast for Crows suffers because it's sort of like a pause.
It retroactively suffers.
It's a pause, and you sort of expect it to be a pause before like
the
action returns. Yeah. And instead, it's a pause before another pause.
And I feel like, but there's some really, really, really good stuff in Dance with Dragons. And were just like, even a two-thirds the length.
Folks, I read through books 6, 7, and 8 of the Wheel of Time series when no one did anything but travel around the countryside on horseback. I think I can handle Feast for Crows.
There's a lot of great character stuff, and there is some, like, the plot stuff that does happen makes you go, oh, hello.
Yeah, the plot points that occur are fantastic. It needs to be a
I've read 800-page fantasy doorstops where no plot happens except for one chapter.
And at least here you get, like, you know, tasty food descriptions.
It's true. So should we round out our discussion of Game of Thrones by bringing up our breakfast conversation over 1 Samuel being the Game of Thrones in the Old Testament?
I'm realizing that there's potential here. There's some marketing potential to create a really fascinating line of, like, Bible study material based on Game of Thrones. Finding the parallels. You know, being like, you think the Bible is boring? The Bible is the original Game of Thrones. You think Cersei's tough? Check out Jezebel. Because, well, yeah, we were talking about, like, you know, we have this sort of our Sunday school memories of the stories, and we as a group did go through and read, you know, 1 Samuel, right. And we read a couple of different things together.
Yeah,
but
at one point we did a Bible study on 1 Samuel.
And sort of reading 1 Samuel, it's like, you see that there is just as much, like, weird court intrigue and betrayal. And, you know, you've got this sort of this story of, like, this priest king who has these horrible children, these terrible sons who are, like, going to lead the kingdom to ruin.
Well, I like your point that the monarchy of, like everything horrible that happens with the monarchy in Israel is not just about the faithlessness of the kings, but comes down to Samuel being a terrible father.
Yeah, because Samuel could not raise his sons well, the Israelites called out for a king. And yeah, just, you know, you have these sort of, like, skeezy generals, you know, who are sort of swapping sides, and, you know, like the scene where, I think, one of David's generals is, like, chasing after, like, the Saul's sole remaining general who killed his brother, and, like, after the wars are all fought and said, like, there's just a stab in the night, and it's, you know, there's just these amazing little moments that are completely scriptural and would make an excellent HBO TV series.
As would Judges.
Yes.
Judges would be intense.
Judges would be a little intense.
Yes, but Judges also has some of the greatest lines. I have a message from the Lord. What is that? Here! Stab!
Judges, the story of Eliud was my, like, one of my favorite Bible studies as a small child. I was clearly twisted and deranged. But it was the triumph of the left-handed. It was the triumph of the left-handed in scripture. I loved it. I think my dad actually told me that when I was like 8 years old.
Now,
I don't know what this says about my relationship
now,
with my father.
Now, here's a question. Can we find parallels between the stories of Joshua and Khal Drogo? or should we just end on that note?
Let's end on that note.
Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Indeed.
Thank you for having me.
From the world of faith, family, fandom, in no particular order. We've been equally yoked. Geek out, y'all.
One Orion, a Roaisha in Vulcan, and Klingon, it's Kapha, which sort of sounds like a threat. Aijalau is Romulan, but not exactly canon, in case we make the fanboys upset. Nikartelegar.